I am your host, Jason Miles. And welcome to a little something different that we're going to do here on This is Revolution Podcast. We have all these shows that we do, up to 5 shows a week. I don't host all of them. Sometimes they're hosted by my good friend, Ben Burgess. And sometimes you guys miss those shows. And I think there's some really good shows. So what I'm trying to do, what I will attempt to do, is do a weekend best of. But not really best of. I mean, you still got to listen to the whole show. But if you follow us on YouTube, you know that we cut clips of the shows. And clip cutting has taken up all of my supposed free time in the last few months. But I think it helps the channel grow. And it's fun. Sometimes people don't have time to sit and watch an entire hour-long episode. Or in the case of The Red Zone, our sports show, a 3-hour episode. Sometimes we talk about sports. But this is going to be a compilation of about 4 shows. There will be a list and a show number for all the shows if you want to go back and listen to these. Some kind of key points of the conversation that I took out. So, again, we're going to be trying to do this every week. Every Friday, this will drop. The TIR Greatest Clips, Volume 1. Enjoy.
Whether or not they're going to be loyal to the Democratic Party this election season. So, if it's affectionately known as the Party of Lincoln, so should it be a no-brainer that black people would embrace the GOP, right? Seriously, has the Democratic Party political failures caused a shift in black voters to disregard the more racist elements of the GOP in favor of their tough-on-crime and fiscally conservative reputation? As we've said many times in the show, the Republicans are winning the messaging war when it comes to the idea that Democrats are soft on immigration and crime. Chicago is a perfect example. When the city was hit by bus loads of migrants, its black residents and leaders resented the city's response to the care of the caravan, almost making it out as a racial warfare for resources. In July of last year, the Oakland NAACP wanted the city of Oakland to declare a state of emergency over the rise of property crime and demanded the city hire 500 more cops. In 2020, people took to the streets to protest the brutal murder of George Floyd and others. Televised killings were replayed millions of times to watch while many were sequestered in our homes. We watched, we see collectively, seeing nothing more. Now the image that plays out loops, is that of lawless cities where the thieves run amok. Public drug use and homelessness encampments not only blight, but interrupt public thoroughfares. Come 2024, can we possibly see a return of Donald Trump in office. What did he, now let's talk about that intro. Let's talk about that intro. Do you think that that's a real effective dissection of what the media thoroughfare is painting the issue as out there right now?
It's interesting because it's mostly on the local level in that intro. And it's fairly easy for voters to turn right wing on the local level when it comes to things like crime or migrants. But as in New York City, you can vote for a Republican mayor and have a Democrat governor and a Democrat president that you've all voted for.
So do you think that the local political machines are in those specific respective cities or locations will have a longer, much more strategic turnout in terms of what happens? For example, should we really expect that the state of California that's been staunchly blue for years is going to turn Republican to support Donald Trump because people are so worried about crime and immigration policy? I don't see that as a reality.
I don't see that as a reality on the national level. On the national level, the stats don't really change. You just have your few battleground states where people have any interest in what's going on. On the local level, yeah, people could start voting for Republicans for sure.
Right, and that could, I mean, I can give you an example of a state where that makes a difference. It's a state like Florida, where you have small segments of black voters peeling away and voting for either not voting or voting for Republicans. That takes a large state like Florida and makes it a giveaway for Donald Trump.
Are we making a distinction between voting for Republicans and registering as Republicans?
That's a very, very, very good question, because one of the phenomenons that I think that we're seeing in some of these polling is that some of these people are voting for Trump, but they're not changing to the Republican Party.
Right, right.
You know, that was a thing that we had in Florida. There were people who voted for Trump as Democrats. Sheerly out of their fundamental frustration with the Democratic Party.
Isn't the Democratic Party infuriating?
Sometimes I wonder if they really are setting themselves up for early demises, or are they that incompetent?
It's true, and it's hard to know, which is really not a good place to be in.
I think the problem the Democratic Party has always suffered from is that they basically represent the same base as the Republicans, which is finance capital, mm-hmm. military industrial complex, and corporate banking sectors. And they have to act as if they're in control, they're interested in the concerns of the working class.
That's true.
So that schizophrenia is what causes them to suffer the kinds of political flops and foibles that they've been doing throughout years.
I think that's very true. We do need a Labor Party in this country. The Democratic Party is not it.
No, that's definitely not the case. I mean, they capitulate to the corporate sector. That's very, very normal intervals. Disadvantaging our working class voters significantly. So let's move on to our questions. So far in the recent midterm election, the liberal city of San Francisco has made a shift to the right with voters passing two very conservative crime bills. One measure, Prop E, blocks the police commission from quickly passing new policies, relaxes rules on officers chasing suspects in vehicles, and opens the door in police using drones. Measure F requires single adults with no children to undergo drug treatment if they are suspected of using drugs. Has the GOP won the messaging war? Now, again, that is a local issue that's local specific. But again, we have been seeing enough reporting on the crime situation in San Francisco, in New York as well. I mean, you live in New York. Mm-hmm. Let's not act like there's not an over amount of concern about crime in New York that's been going on since COVID also.
Right. Right. There used to be roving bands of children robbing places like Sephora and Saks and all these very high scale, upscale boutiques since COVID.
Really?
Actually, before COVID. But yeah.
Post George Floyd.
Yeah.
Wow. What was the reaction to that?
Well, obviously they used the kids because the kids aren't going to get into serious trouble. But the reaction was kind of exaggerated. Kind of exaggerated. They clamped down.
Well, in cities like we have in San Francisco, we've seen massive exaggerations, not exaggerations, but increases in drug crime, homelessness.
Right.
We have petty thefts, larcenies, smash and grabs of cars.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to question, that there's a legitimacy to the concerns of those states, are we?
No, we're not going to question that. Those are legit concerns.
But you think that the way in which crime is being framed in the California cities is being done in a way that's disingenuous?
I think so. I saw a video with one woman who said that we're already on the left. We're just asking to move a little bit to the right.
Wow.
Yeah, I thought that was disturbing. So we're just asking to move just a scooch, just a little bit to the right. And maybe that's how a lot of people see this. Or they see it as asking for what is basic. I saw another guy in a video saying they just want what's basic. They want what the officials and mayors and everyone is saying, but they want them to mean it.
Do you think that this definitely means that the languaging on crime has been won by the GOP?
I think so. It's almost invisibilized by the people. They don't see it as themselves really moving rightwards.
Is there any way to address the issue of crime from a left progressive perspective without surrendering to some of these more ridiculous kind of, defund concepts mm-hmm. that come out of academia that do not have any real-world salience?
I would think the left approaches would be more holistic, which would require money, which could be a real problem in terms of the budgets. But, the fund has showed us you can move money around in a budget. That doesn't have to be taboo. But I would think a leftward response would be more holistic, more getting to the root of the problems. What do you think?
I mean, I think the I would assume that the left would have the capacity to address the issue of crime in a way that confronts political economy and the actual social realities that creates crime, poverty, and things of that nature, as opposed to just demonizing poor people as being the, you know, the treaties of the streets that just need to be purged.
Shifting gears a little bit, one place it seems the millennial left has had some success is in the media. Nowhere as large as the multinational corporations that run media conglomerates in the West, but much more successful than underground zines. Is this a good thing? What happens to a left that has its most successful base in online spaces and not organizations?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question, one to which I don't really have a direct answer. Obviously, you know, given the choice between having a base in the media and having various media outlets, autonomous ones, as well as having representatives being picked up on mainstream media talk shows, that versus having trade unions, political parties, various group of schools organizing and getting together in real life, you would definitely choose the latter. Right, I think that should be fairly, that you'd hope that should be self-evident. I think a lot of the left has often felt, certainly in the period of the past 40-50 years, if only we had a megaphone, then we could win, right? So if only we could get these people off of watching Fox News, or even I don't know what all the news channels you have, CBS News, sure, MSNBC, whatever. If we could be on there and just be shouting at people through there, then they would know, right? But instead, they're brainwashed by the mainstream media. I mean, that's a very Gen X style of politics, which the millennial left has slightly left behind. And in fact, the way that the millennial left overcame that Gen X, that bad Gen X politics of perceiving everyone as brainwashed, as everyone a dupe, sheeple out there, who, if only they listened to the right people in the media, then things would be better. The way that that was overcome, ironically, was by the millennials becoming enamored with new media and thinking, aha, now we have this, you know, at worst polycentric, but in practice, very sort of autonomous media landscape with all these little things sprouting up. I can get on Facebook and talk to the world directly. I can organize a protest on there. I don't have to rely anymore on getting the BBC or CNN to report on my protest and making it go massive. Now it's in our hands. And so the left fell in love with media again because of the internet.
Did it fall in love with media, or did it fall in love with itself? Because there's something very narcissistic people on the podcast. Yeah.
I'm just looking at myself on the screen here. I'm not even looking at you, man. I'm just looking at myself.
As two dudes that make a living, you know, looking at themselves and other people on a screen, realistically, is there something somewhat narcissistic about this moment where everyone has the megaphone? Meat spaces are dead because we can do it all online. This has been said over and over again, and people go, well, that's not really. It's like, yeah, it's still kind of happening.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's – do you remember the cover of Time magazine in 2012, 2013, the person of the year? And the person of the year was, it was just like a mirrored cover. So as if to say, you're the person of the year. And I'm like, oh, fucking awesome.
Seriously, I was thinking about this as I was reading your piece, and I remembered a conversation I had with Doug Lane a year or so ago, where we were talking about the Truman Show. And I'm like, are we all in the Truman Show now? Because it does feel like that moment. Joshua Citronella, probably said his name wrong. Citrellia. Josh,
if I said your name wrong,
if I said your name wrong, Josh, you have permission to punch me in the nuts. I'm sorry. But he wrote a very interesting piece on these kind of crazy political ideologies he found online. We joke about it with this image right here. This Calhoun Leninism.
That's like MAGA communism, isn't it?
Yeah. Kind of like the MAGA communism thing. There's all these kind of odd ideologies that don't make sense. And you can do that in this current medium.
But I think that points to the fact that, you know, this would have been a critique that would have been directed pretty much to the left, and maybe not, you know, people might go, well, no, but not the various kind of socialist little groups, but broadly speaking, the kind of cultural left as a whole, right? So we were talking about people in the media, academia, everybody kind of progressive, all sort of progressive across the side. It would be directed at that, primarily at that sort of group. The thing is that now this is across society. This is, you know, as I talked before about the way that victim politics has become completely cross spectrum. Well, the kind of media narcissism also is now cross spectrum. It's no longer an issue which you say, well, this is something problematic on the left. So I think that to a certain extent means that we have to change our critique of it and how we approach it. But yeah, I mean, you know, you put it back to me, like maybe we didn't fall in love with media again. We fell in love with ourselves. I think there's a lot of truth to that insofar as we saw ourselves reflected much more directly in a way that we didn't see ourselves reflected in CNN back in 1990 or whatever. Right.
I mean, look at the Sanders moment for a second. Those cats that were part of this, not everybody, but a lot of people that were in that campaign, that party, were working for Sanders. Sirota writes a script that I think was Oscar nominated. Breonna Joy Gray's got a podcast. Nina Turner had a podcast. Like a lot of those people went into media. They didn't go back and work on other campaigns. Again, I'm only speaking domestically. I can't speak for the people that work for Corbyn.
But there was a similar process that happened in Britain. And I mean, you know, I think even to pick a really farcical example, Pablo Iglesias, who was the leader of Podemos, the kind of left populist party in Spain, which emerged from the streets, from those occupations that I was talking about. Mm-hmm. And then academics got together and formed an actual political party, which you think, oh, that's good. That's progress. That's way better than just occupying a square. Occupying the square has actually led to some real concrete politics of a political party. And then they got into bed with the kind of mainstream neoliberal center-left party, and that killed any kind of radical credentials they had. They got identified as being at the same time too establishment and too leftist, which I think is interesting. And then, you know, now it's kind of all kind of gone. I mean, you know, it still exists, but and now I took the piss out of this on Twitter the other day, but you know, Pablo Iglesias is now setting up a bar in Madrid, and you know, okay, that's fine.
Yeah, you did. I saw that.
Nothing against that. I would love to have my own bar in Madrid. I mean, Madrid's great. Love the bar. Blah 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 blah. But the thing is, it's all lefty branded. So all the drinks and the cocktails are all have like, you know, Fidel Castro or Leon Trotsky or whatever it might be
named about that.
It's just so kitsch that I'm like, I just find it very cringe. So anyway, I kind of feel like that's itself a kind of its own coda on the millennial left. But you know, to talk about media, I think that it is the positive way to look at it, I think, would if it were this, and I don't think it is, it's that this is a moment of very deep political crisis, and I think the backwash of the wave of millennial left activism should allow us to be actually asking really deep questions about what politics is and can be or should be at a very fundamental level. I think we might have to go way back. Right, kind of forget everything about the 20th century. Go all the way back to the beginning of the 19th century, maybe. Because I think our position historically might be more analogous to that than it is, you know, before the formation of the working classes, of the proletariat, and its emergence in the mid 19th century. Maybe we're in a position more comparable to the 1830s or something like that. And I say all that because I think we have to be serious about considering at least the possibility that we might need to rethink everything from scratch and try to avoid, therefore, these little shortcuts to kind of like, oh, let's just pick things up where we left off in the 1970s, pretend neoliberalism never happened, and just roll back neoliberalism as if neoliberalism was just some bad ideas which bad people came in and implemented, and they were more powerful and we can stop them and we could just reverse it, which is not the case. The neoliberalism was a fundamentally a crisis of the whole post-war order, which couldn't continue because the system runs on profits, and profits were squeezed then. And so for the system to run, they had to do something else. Neoliberalism worked. Neoliberalism worked for the system. It worked. It was necessary for it. There was no other solution. The solution was revolution.
Would you say it worked again for people in the 90s during the Clinton years to the early 2000s?
I think to a certain extent, because it finds also neoliberalism is able to remedy its legitimation problems, not so much its accumulation problems, right? So it's not about not so much the profitability question, but about how much trust the regime has. It was able to resolve that by adopting kind of more lefty ideas. So you had the original neoliberalism of Thatcher and Reagan, which was nasty and horrible and right wing, and which maybe sold to certain people if they were yuppies and aspirational, but for other people not. But the Clinton Blair moment, and even up through to the Obama, and indeed what Hillary Clinton was trying to sell, was one which said, well, look, you get under this regime, you get gender equality, you get racial equality, all the old prejudices and bigotry and whatever is being left in the past. Of course, they have to keep saying, no, but actually it's a big threat because you need to keep buying into it. But at the same time, the sell is that, well, you don't want to go back to the old racist and sexist 1970s. What you've got now is you've got a real win here. You're more free now than you were before. You can consume your freedom.
We were consuming our freedom in the 90s and early 2000s. Financial deregulation in the United States, and I'm not saying this is a great thing. I'm just explaining the moment. Due to financial deregulation starting about 94, really, right? The end of Glass-Steagall. Yeah. A lot of people are lifted temporarily. The word doing the heavy lifting is temporarily out of poor and working class into middle class, and from middle class to
there's loads of private credit sloshing around the system.
Oh god, yeah.
And a load of cheap commodities coming over from China. So, you know, a TV, which would have been an expensive thing to buy, suddenly, like, it's one of, if you look at kind of commodities whose price has like really dropped over the past 20 years, TVs have become suddenly really cheap. You can have loads of TVs, right? And you can have and you have credit to buy that. And so that buys a certain amount of legitimacy, right? It worked for a while. I don't know where we were with media in relation to that, but I think, like,
you can watch on your smart TV. That's
what anyway, I know where I was going with that. To kind of loop back, my point is that insofar as media provides a venue for reflection, discussion, debate, which you guys do very well on This Is Revolution, we try to do it on BungaCast, I think that's good, right? And I think that's important, especially right now, because it just simply going out and acting and as we've seen, as I write in my essay, as these books testify to, hasn't been productive. We've ended up in many ways in a worse situation than we were in 2012 or something. So I think in that regard, it's good. On the other hand, and what is probably more realistic, is that a lot of the kind of mediatization and media focus of the left is a way probably of avoiding these discussions. And for a lot of people, for individuals, just to kind of have a sustainable kind of life and have some public profile and whatever, which, whatever, good for them. That's not what we started this for, right? Exactly.
None of us started this so we can get recognized, you know, at the local coffee shop. The question I have for that, you know, and I'm not, I'll play an honest devil's advocate with that statement, as I agree with you. Mm-hmm. Especially during the deregulated 90s and early 2000s, it is through financial deregulation that so many Black people do get a small taste for, and brown people as well, of middle class security through no income verifying, low start rate home loans, right?
High risk.
Yeah, we won't get into all this. That's a whole different show if you want to. And there's better books on it that can go into more detail than we could go into in an hour long.
Sure.
But that reality still rings true, even for the children that grew up in the aftermath of 2008. So either you got a small taste of the middle class opulence for a while, like my kids, and then you get the rug pulled from under you, but you understand what that looks like.
Right.
So how do you tell people that that's a bad thing per se? Because as someone that's tried to have that conversation, how do you have that conversation with people? It's one thing to say, it sounds nice, and it almost sounds like flowery language, that there's all these wonderful things that are rights. But we all know that there's human rights, and your rights are not the same. So shelter is a commodity. And how many Black folks do we know that make their living as landlords? It's aspiration, like you said. So how do you tell people that aspiration may not be
right? Yeah, well, so a couple of things. There's a group of people who we will not convince. I'm not against the idea of people purchasing, you know, homes if that's what they see, you know, as their immediate interest in this moment, right? It's not like the society is changing tomorrow. But I just think there are ways that we can extend housing to a greater number of people and in a way that we cannot do right now in this sort of for-profit single homeowner model, right? It just has not worked. As you point out, in the case of the subprime mortgage crisis, it was in reach for a lot of people, but it was in reach in a way that was ultimately disastrous.
Oh.
I just got done teaching, you know, in the last weeks, a section on housing. And we spent a lot of time getting into this process of decommodification and some of the alternatives. There's a couple we can talk about here, if the audience is interested. But, you know, social housing. And so the U.S. failed historically with public housing. We funded it because in the short run, you know, chambers of commerce, building trades, unions, different economic interests within cities supported it because they were in favor of slum clearance. And so were a lot of social reformers who wanted better and safer and more sanitary housing for poor people. And so it was a short run coalition that brought us public housing across the country. But ultimately, right, we didn't support it. We didn't fund it at the national level in a way that would have sustained it, primarily because people thought it was a communist idea, right? It went against the grain of how, you know, at that time, people are promoting housing as a economic commodity, as a way of building wealth, as a way of creating a nation of nominal property owners, right? So one thing we could do, right, is we could reinvent the notion of public housing, maybe more along the lines as they've done in places like Austria, right? And I mean, Austria's housing is not what it was in an earlier period where it was state run and state managed. Now they've moved to a model that involves still some private investment, you know, whether it's construction companies or architects. But there's a heavy state influence in what happens. And there's much more in the way of the goal of creating communities. And I think that's one of the things we got away from when we tried to do public housing here. Mm-hmm. Most people didn't care about the community that existed there from the very beginning. I mean, there may have been some different amenities put in place. But if you look at the Austrian model by comparison, I mean, what they've done essentially is that there's subsidization from the state in at least three different ways. There's land grants that happen, so you're situating social housing in places that are oftentimes prime real estate in gentrifying areas, in you know, on waterfronts, right? So it's not like you're doing as we did in the U.S. with public housing. You put, you know, the tower in the garden somewhere else off the highway, away from the surrounding urban fabric. And so there's much more intentional integration of these new housing complexes. There's also much more in the way of public participation in what happens. I mean, even to the point of tenants being able to partially design the units that they're going to occupy. There's much more focus on integrating different kinds of people within the life cycle. And so retirees, as well as, you know, families with small children, students, professionals, people on lower incomes. And so there's a tendency to try to integrate different kinds of people and to make sure that over time, these people remain in place, right?
Mm-hmm.
Another one of those investments that happens, I mean, is the support in terms of how the construction happens, right? The state is also involved in it. But then on the other side, there's subsidies to help with the paying of the rent once people are in the units. And so multiple layers of state investment, as opposed to what we did, which was to build something and then really pull away federal support and expect those buildings to survive over the long haul. You know, complexes like the Pruitt-Igoe homes in St. Louis, or, you know, Taylor, Cabrini Green here in Chicago, right? We expected those places to survive on the tenants' incomes and the tenants' rents, which was already inadequate, right? So how would you, allow those massive complexes to be maintained on that low of a budget, right, and without federal support? And so I think we could do things differently. Another example that we need to revisit, and I strongly encourage everybody to take a look at a documentary that's available online. It's really short. It's not like a fancy, you know, cinematic wonder. It's a basic, straightforward story of Co-op City in the Bronx, you know, northernmost reaches of the Bronx.
Mm-hmm.
Co-op City remains the largest cooperative housing complex in the world right now. And it was one of dozens of cooperative complexes that were built across New York City. And we saw the, you know, this is heavy union involvement, right? Unions and other progressives were involved in building these complexes. And, you know, what you end up with in this case is a situation where, you know, there's more in the way of ownership, right? And more collective ownership. It's not the, you know, the privatized model. And it was actually designed as a way of helping people who weren't eligible for public housing, but they also could not aspire to the Levittown, you know, single family home model, right? And so it met people who were kind of in the middle, like nominal homeowners. And it was also progressive racially. This is something that we should remember. We should say it every time somebody tries to trash, you know, the American left as, you know, always white and super racist. There were provisions in places like Co-op City to make sure that in the beginning, there was at least 20% minority occupants. And there was a moment when, you know, in terms of the governing of Co-op City, it was dominated mostly by white and Jewish residents. And they actually stepped back and said, this is a problem, and tried to figure out a way to bring about more representation of Black and brown people. You look at Co-op City today, and it's overwhelmingly working class. But I think somewhere around the neighborhood of about 70% Black and Latino. And so, you know, it still survives. It has some of the lowest crime rates, lower than the rest of the boroughs. And so this is possible. It's doable. We can figure out ways to bring, you know, quality housing within reach of people. It should not be based on the single family model, which is also ecologically disastrous, right? It's inefficient to have so many different, palatial and irrational, small single family homes all around the country, right? A lot of these places are empty, especially as people age up. And so there's other models that we can use. I saw somebody in the chat mention community land trust. That's another one that we could talk about as well. But I just think these are ways of, you know, again, creating opportunities or possibilities for people to have housing, to have a home without necessarily relying on the strictly for-profit private ownership model. And so I'm excited about the possibilities. I think people are having these conversations again. And it will be interesting now that, you know, in Chicago, we're talking about the redistributive dimension of all of this. Mm-hmm. If we could also add to that some solutions that don't just, you know, rehash the same old things we've heard before, tiny houses and all sorts of other things that people have proposed when it comes to housing, you know, the homeless, right? There's other ways we can approach this.
Take a call. Calling from a 425 area code caller. What is your name and where are you calling from?
Hey, it's JC. I'm calling from the middle of KLC. Ramadan Mubarak.
Ramadan Kareem.
Well, it's actually Jezhne Pirozbeh, but okay.
Thank you, JC. What did you want to talk about tonight, JC?
It's all right. I think I might have a low key rant at you guys.
Go for
about
it.
Some of the topics that have been discussed. About the trans debate. There's this weird talking point that come up, like, what happened to all the tomboys?
Mm-hmm.
Nobody is getting rid of the tomboys. You know why you don't think tomboys? It's because you work at home or work in academia. The tomboys are in the military. That's where they are. Nobody's transing the tomboys in the military.
Mm-hmm. So you think every tomboy is no longer four, but they're all 18 and above, or what?
It's just, sure, there's kids, but if you think that they're going away, you're just not looking in the right place.
I've never said they're going away. I've never said anything about. Okay, I was going to say, because I'm not saying that anyone's going
anywhere. It wasn't you. It wasn't actually anybody on the show.
Okay.
Although I am subtweeting someone in the TR Sublation universe.
That's a whole different look, man. I'm not going to be guilty by association. No, not me.
Is this one of those conversations that speculate?
I'm friends with Doug, but I've never agreed with everything he said.
Is this one of those conversations that speculates on one of the secondary or tertiary consequences of transgenderism on alternative sexual lifestyles? Remember, I think it was Glenn Greenwald was stuck on the notion that an increase in transgenderism somehow has an adverse effect on lesbianism or something like that. I mean, I remember people talking like that. I was like, what is that
about? There's a discussion that's a very uncomfortable that we have to admit that people are not ready to have at this moment about an idea that maybe some people might force their kids into gender identity when it's not really necessary.
Well, a lot of this stuff is new. It's new medical procedures, new medical science. There's going to be difficulties. There's going to be things to work out. There's going to be mistakes, right? And I think that's a really important point to understand about when we talk about trans-affirming healthcare. I mean, I don't know what is the appropriate healthcare issue. But I can tell you this, when we're talking about grown-up people who are 18 years old and over and who have the right to go and like die for their country if they want to get plastic surgery as part of gender-affirming care to engage in sex change operations, then like that is their prerogative and that is their right. Exactly. And in a civilized society, you know, people should treat them the way that they want to be treated. It's like, you know, people don't go around anymore calling black people boy or the N-word in public, because that's just not freaking polite. You might in your heart of hearts want to call every black person the N-word. Keep that to yourself. You might in your heart of hearts believe, you know, think that, you know, I think this whole transgender issue stuff is ridiculous. I don't think trans women are really women. Fine. But why do you need to be rude to someone in public and try and humiliate them in public? Are there cringy aspects of the trans movement? There are some cringy aspects of it. There are some people who behave a bit ridiculously, but tell me a political movement that where there isn't somebody who takes it ridiculously or acts ridiculously or behaves ridiculously. People want to act like everything is settled science around what all this stuff means. It's all work in progress. We've only just got past the kind of social problems. I mean, think about it. Forget about trans issues. 20 years ago, they were still like debating whether gay people should have equal rights, right? Mm-hmm. Within the system. And when we talk about trans issues, we're not dealing with, this is not the same thing as homosexuality or bisexuality. This is like a different level of issue. This is something that often involves quite an invasive medical intervention, which may be necessary for people's mental health and things like that. But it's going to take time for us to get these longitudinal studies coming out, because we see the medical advice around this change over time. Do you give people transitioning under the age of 18 puberty blockers? They were at one point, but then the medical advice has changed in some places on that. And I'm not qualified to speak about what is and what is appropriate healthcare. But what I can say is that in terms of treating people humanely, you know, I think we should respect trans women, trans men, and how they want to be. And I don't think being a tomboy and being a trans person is necessarily the same thing. Maybe there was a point in history where you would be a tomboy because that's the only option you have, right? Mm-hmm. But now you have an option of if you want to transition, you can do that, right? And it's going to take time. And I'm telling you, I agree with some of these kind of more, let's say, TERF-orientated people who say, well, there's going to be a lot of lawsuits from detransitioners and stuff down the road. I have no doubt that will happen. Because, again, when you have a for-profit medical system, you may end up with misdiagnosis, right? You know, but just because somebody was misdiagnosed and went through a medical transition and that was wrong and a mistake doesn't make the entire that treatment program necessarily wrong. Like if you gave someone chemotherapy for a toothache, then, you know,
we don't throw chemo out the window.
Yeah. So again, I don't know what is appropriate, and I don't know, you know, how we square all this with also the other kind of discourse where people should be comfortable in their own bodies and people should be taught to love their own bodies. I don't know how we square all that stuff, but people really need to like ratchet down the kind of ratchet down the discourse, and of course not fall into the trap of hating on people, I guess. I don't know. That's my thoughts.
Makes sense.
Well, Carl, are you still there? Wait, we have another comment about MT. Somehow, how did this start, MT? So glad MT found coverage for her shift tonight at the hybrid Ross Church's chicken.
This is a you thing.
But how did we...
They have Church's chicken in Iraq, but it's called Texas chicken.
Wait, what? Do people in Iraq know that Church's chicken puts stuff in it to make Arabs sterile? Did Gene freeze, or that's just his face?
George Church's chicken.
No. Gene, your computer froze and made you look so British and smug. I'm sure one of the kids kicked something. Do you guys remember that rumor about Church's Chicken?
It's certainly a rumor. It's still a rumor.
But do you remember it, though?
Of course.
When they would say Church's Chicken, they put something in the chicken to make black people sterile, but like it was black people in particular.
Sterile,
like
white, blind, people. Not be able to read, all kinds of stuff.
I never heard the not be able to
not
read
be
thing.
Able to read.
That's awesome. Like, can you imagine going to the church? I think I'll have a two-piece with a biscuit. You come out, you're just talking like a stereotype. Viana thinks that's funny. You think that's funny, Viana, that chicken makes you talk like a stereotype? Someone says they have Texas chicken in New Zealand. Well, Stuart McGill, apparently, if you are Maori in New Zealand and eat Texas chicken, you will be sterile and illiterate. That's not where you want to be when Jesus comes, Stuart McGill. The anaconda malt liquor of Iraq. It makes you Did you ever hear those rumors, Gene Bajlan, about Church's Chicken when you were in Iraq? No?
I'm afraid I didn't. I didn't even know there was a company called Church's Chicken, to be honest. I'd never heard of it before going to Iraq. There's a couple of U.S. chains which we don't have in the U.K., but they do have in the Middle East. For example, my first time enjoying Arby's meats was in Istanbul.
Arby's.
I hate Arby's. Anyone that tells you they likes, or any American that tells you they like Arby's, is a CIA plant.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
They do good curly fries.
See, you get a pass because you're not from here. But if you were Marlon and you said that,
there was a scandal in Missouri with a preacher who was caught on Grindr hooking up with young men, and his kind of pickup line was, "Hey, I'll give you a free Arby's meats." What's his name? Gift card.
Oh, a gift card.
He was a sugar daddy, and he was paying people in the Arby's
gift card. That should tell you something.
His idea of the meats.
We have the meats, I suppose. I suppose Arby's.
What about the meat heads?
Whoa! Yes,
what about the meat heads, Zal? That is a good question.
Someone says, "I guess my teenage self was psyoped." Dude, nobody eats at Arby's, dude.
I don't know, man. There's a lot of people who eat Arby's in the Midwest.
You know what? Follow them around, and you'll find out that they're
Arby's
either
known for what? Their roast beef sandwiches.
Gene is over there trying to silence his child and not get the police called on him at the same time.
He's cover the nose.
He's singing for you.
Gene's so used to beating him or threatening him with a whooping, he can't do that with the camera on him.
Gene is too more modern day to think about people. Gene does not beat his children. He's the most caring, loving, adoring, modern, politically correct parent in the world.
Politically correctly kicks that little boy's behind when he gets
no, he did. Hitting doesn't work.
We tried.
Psychological abuse is where it's at, guys. Yeah. Right, Zal?
Yeah.
Although it can backfire on you, but
well, we have a call. We have a call here.
Let's take a call.
Let's take a call.